We human beings are a curious bunch. From the baby who first crawls away from the protective circle of his mother's arms to explore the hidden crannies of his home, to the tribal islander who hollows out a canoe to carry him beyond the waters that touch the earth where he was born, to the mystic who seeks to know the mysteries of his own mind. The urge to venture beyond the next horizon seems to be built into what and who we are. And since there's no horizon that stretches as far as space itself, it just follows that human beings want to get out there and take a look around. Nadine Epstein is an ordinary earthling living in Washington, D.C., a mere 75 kilometers beneath the velvet void that we know as space. She remembers the thought she had while looking into the night sky as a Girl Scout.
When I was a little girl, I looked to the stars, and I knew that the answers were in the stars. And I couldn't understand why everyone else didn't know this and why we didn't put all our effort together to go out there and find the answers. Let's go. I'm going to take my son and my husband, and we're going off there. Next spaceship available, we'll be on it.
While Ms. Epstein was watching the heavens from her sleeping bag at camp, events in the real world were paving the way that would help realize the dream she shared with so many of her ancestors. In 1961, John Glenn became the first American to orbit the Earth. Later that year, President Kennedy made a speech before Congress that would inspire the world and help refashion human destiny.
Now it is time to take longer strides. Time for a great new American enterprise. Time for this nation to take a clearly leading role in space achievement, which in many ways may hold the key to our future on Earth. I believe that this nation should commit itself to achieving the goal, before this decade is out, of landing a man on the moon and returning him safely to the Earth.
Somewhere in music, how high the moon is, the stars. Everybody flying through the stars, through the skies, through the moon, through the sun, and round to Jupiter, Pluto, Mars, stars, every planet around through the skies.
Dick Jacobson, whose dazzling career in aviation and aerospace stretches back to the days of Charles Lindbergh, was one of those helping to make the science fiction President Kennedy proposed as a science fact. He describes what he felt the first time he witnessed a launch of the U.S. space shuttle.
Watching that massive vehicle riding on these great tongues of fire, I was yelling like a child, go, 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 go. I got out of flying school over 50 years ago. Higher, faster, further is always what you were looking for. Now, I don't know of anything higher, faster, further than things that are in orbit. It's really a continuum. Our ancestors could dream about getting off the Earth and victory over gravity. We're seeing it, all right? And that's exciting. I bet you if you'd known where Columbus was going to wind up, you'd have stood on the dock cheering, you know. God, that's the first trip to America. It's hard not to be enthusiastic. What is it they say? There are more stars in the sky than there are grains of sand in the desert. You know, my God, can we not afford to find out what's out there?
Astronauts report it feels good. T-minus 15 seconds. Guidance is internal. 12. 11, 10, 9, ignition sequence start, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0, all engine running, liftoff, we have a liftoff.
But what is takeoff really like for those who have experienced the weightless world? Mike Lounge, a three-time astronaut, relates the experience of climbing through the sky while strapped into the cockpit of the shuttle orbiter.
On my first flight, I was sitting right between the pilot and the co-pilot, so I had a good view of everything that was going on. I could look out a window over my left shoulder and look down at the launch pad as it very quickly became a small dot down below. It's like a ride on an old wooden roller coaster. Fairly violent. After 2 minutes, you're up above the atmosphere and the buffeting goes away. And then it's just a smooth, constant push. It takes about 10 minutes to get into space is all. And finally, the engine's cut off and your checklist floats up in front of your face and your pencil floats up and your stomach floats up to about your neck. And you say, wow, we really did it.
Higher primates like us, and in fact all Earth-bred species, are so accustomed to gravity that we really don't notice our constant weary struggle to cope with its effects. Once in space, however, the experience of weightlessness is both joyful and refreshing. Astronaut Mike Lounge.
You can sit on the ceiling. You can do somersaults very rapidly, spinning around. Your brain has decided we can deal with it. I've often wondered what it would be like to take an 8-year-old child up there and let them play for a week. What we end up having is 30 and 40-year-old children up there. Playing with your food is fun.
But the deepest and most common experiences astronauts report are not fun exactly, unless one enjoys having one's personal perspective rearranged. All it takes is the first good look out the window at space and the gorgeous blue orb of one's origins.
You float up to the window and you look out, and the first reaction is one of awe. Oh my God, the harsh, harsh blackness of space, and everything is so crisp, and there's no fuzz on anything. And then this thin blue shield, delicate blue, that's the atmosphere. And what you think about is, my God, it's tiny. And then there's the Earth. It's just an incredible experience.
With experiences like this, returning to Earth almost always feels like a letdown in more ways than one.
You finally get ready to come back home and you get suited up and turn the ship around backwards and slow down by about 1%. That's all it takes. And then you start scraping along the top of the atmosphere and gradually get slower and slower. As you do that, the gravity effects start to build up very slowly. So what I remember is holding a pencil out in front of me and letting go, and it very slowly sunk down to the console. And that was the saddest thing that I'd ever seen. And I remember thinking, what am I ever going to do to top this adventure?
Going into space has a very big draw for many people, myself included, just for the sheer pleasure of it. I've heard it described and like to think of it as extremely natural. Many people feel that way.
Lori Garver understands Mike Lounge's sadness in returning to Earth. As executive directory of the National Space Society, a 30,000-member space advocacy group that wants to create a spacefaring civilization, Ms. Garver believes that it's human destiny to live in space, because, she says, space may actually be our heritage.
People who were seafarers in the early days could not get enough when they went out to sea. They had to go back. There was a drawing. And many of us believe that is because all the origins of life comes from the sea. We came out of the sea to breathe the first breath of life, so it was a natural longing to go back to sea, and seafarers often recount this. Even more profoundly, I believe, we come from space in the sense that we all are made out of stellar and planetary material, and we are just a part of this ongoing continuum. So as we go into space, we're really going home. We're not venturing away from home. We're going to the beginning, where we come from.
The idea of space as our original home has gained some credence among serious students of history and human development. Terence McKenna is the author of Food of the Gods and The Invisible Landscape.
It's a recapturing of the amniotic life in the womb, the one time in your life when problems were pretty much under control. The fetus in the womb is basically in a state of weightlessness. And I think probably there's a tremendously deep nostalgia for the recovery of that, and it takes the form of an erotic impulse. I mean, the unknown, we want to go into that mystery. In sexual encounters, in the exploration of distant lands in the 19th century, in the urge to explore space, there is always this sense of pushing into the body of the unknown, the blackness of Mother Night.
Biology, of course, looks forward, not just backward. There's an old story of two caterpillars crawling lazily along the ground when they look up to see a beautiful butterfly appear on the horizon. The butterfly wafts past them gracefully on the breeze. When it is safely out of sight, one caterpillar turns to the other one and exclaims, "Hmm, you'll never get me up in one of those." This joke may have something serious to say about biology, space, and the human future. Again, Terence McKenna.
It is built into biology to expand its niches, its horizons, and the dimensions in which it can operate, and that in the same way that life left the sea some 600 million or so years ago, space represents another symmetry break where biology, with the human species acting as the point species, actually breaks with the flattened geometry of the planetary surface. Our beautiful small planet is still only a tiny corner of a universe that we sense must swarm with habitats, opportunities, perhaps civilizations with their art, their philosophy, their music.
The push to space is not based entirely on sweetness and light, however. According to Mr. McKenna, humans may need this new frontier partly as an antidote to our own restlessness here on Earth.
In terms of what is possible in space, I'm very bullish on it because I think that through the intercession of modern science, the human imagination has been empowered to such a degree that it is no longer safe to unleash it on the surface of the planet. I mean, hydrogen bombs, ozone holes, enormous urban concentrations of technology, these things are killing the planet. On the other hand, if we were up there, the human imagination could be unfolded in the domain of deep space without the toxic and antisocial consequences that we see that has begun to carry for us in the limited environment of the Earth. We stand now in a situation where if we do not make the leap to some other dimension, we'll be judged an evolutionary failure and nature will just close the accounts on us.
According to one new but widely held scientific idea, human migration to space would benefit not only the humans who go there, but the very planet itself. In this view, the Earth is most accurately understood as a living, self-regulating organism in its own right, and living beings of the Earth are considered specialized organs and cells within its body. To put it in folk terminology, the Earth really is good old Mother Nature, and all living things play a part in keeping her body healthy and whole. In recent years, this body has been steadily ravaged by human excess.
Flying Mother Nature's silver seed to a new home in the sun. Flying Mother Nature's silver seed to a new
Dr. Otter Zell, the naturalist who first propounded this idea, believes that space migration may be biology's two-pronged survival strategy to save both high-tech humanity and the fragile living Earth.
Our own solar system, as far as we can tell, seems to be basically lifeless. But certainly the Moon and Mars and Venus and the larger moons that we've been able to really study are, this much we know. But if we seed them with life, these can be green, they can bloom, we can terraform the nearby planets. Mother Nature's seed and life will spread throughout the solar system and perhaps throughout the galaxy, and perhaps we will meet other living planetary systems that are doing the same thing. And hopefully we can come together on that level as fellow creatures, meeting as brothers and sisters of the galactic mother, you know?
Flying Mother Nature's silver seed to a new home.
Creatures from outer space will have to remain science fiction until we meet them. But artificial space colony habitats, where 10,000 or more people could live in an environment virtually like Earth with blue skies and fresh air, are possible today with existing technology, an idea first put forth by the Princeton physicist Gerard K. O'Neill in the early 1970s. Each spinning donut-shaped colony would be free to pursue its own social and political agenda in physical isolation. At the same time, each colony would be electronically linked to the others, making possible communication between them within 24 hours anywhere in the solar system. Dr. James Trefel, the distinguished Clarence J. Robinson Professor of Physics at George Mason University, believes that space colonies are much more attractive habitats than planets for one very practical reason.
If you look at the solar system as in terms of gravity, it's sort of a gently sloping field with a couple of very deep holes in it. The gently sloping field is toward the sun, and the deep holes are the planets, deep, narrow holes. And we're down in one of those holes. Now, we can pull ourselves out, which is what we're doing with the space program. But once we do, it seems to me kind of pointless to just run over someplace else and fall back into another one. I think that the future of space will be, as Gerard O'Neill predicted, in space colonies, that people will build artificial habitats near where the resources are, the resources in space being the materials in the asteroids and the energy from the sun.
The many asteroids in space can make us all very rich indeed. Asteroids are minor orbiting residents of the inner solar system that are too small to be considered planets, but which contain far more gold, nickel, and other precious metals than have ever existed on Earth. This makes asteroids wonderfully lucrative places to mine, especially if they're conveniently alongside one's Hawaii-like space habitat. Energy is also cheap in space, where 1 second of a sunlight equals all power that humans have ever consumed on Earth. And of course, the amount of space in space is truly enormous. Still, in the end, Dr. Trefel feels it will be something other than mere money that will ultimately take us deeper into the great out there.
If you look at past civilizations and you ask, you know, what did they do that we think is really important? They produced the pyramids, they produced the cathedrals, the great works of art. And I think space exploration falls into that category. It's something we'll do because it's what we are. I think of the people who built Chartres Cathedral, for example. We don't know who built it. I mean, they didn't leave their names. But people came there on pilgrimages and worked to build the cathedral, in their language, to the glory of God. You know, our cathedrals, our pyramid, is going to be the exploration of space. When somebody 500 years from now looks back on the 20th century, they're not going to talk about the Second World War. They're not going to talk about the election. They're not going to talk about anything. What they're going to talk about is that was the century that human beings first set foot on the moon. That's what we'll be remembered for. That's not a bad thing to be remembered for, by the way.